Well, the Iowa caucus is behind us, and the candidates for president are focusing their attention and campaign cash on New Hampshire, the second major stop on the front end of the official presidential campaign season. Iowa and New Hampshire have stood together as the first two candidate hurdles, winnowing the field, setting the stage for what comes next. Some are asking why these two events are always first. Isn't it someone else's turn? Is the process best served by these two small states setting the tone for the entire presidential campaign? Well, that's one of the things we'll address this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show. John Munson in for Kathleen this week. My guest is Claire Foran, associate editor at The Atlantic. A recent article of hers caught our eye. It was titled, "The Uncertain Fate of Early Voting States. Iowa and New Hampshire's Political Clout Could Ride on the Results of the 2016 Race." And so here we are. Here's how to get in touch if you want to join our conversation this afternoon, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email is talk@wpr.org. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. Claire Foran, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, really, we're going to take away Iowa's pride of place. I mean, what else do they have to look forward to? What are they left with? They don't have an NFL team. They don't have a Major League Baseball team. Would we deny ourselves the drama of watching candidates go to the Iowa State Fair to eat some fried thing on a stick or yell at people from the Des Moines Register soapbox? I mean, this is such wonderful political theater. Why would we deny ourselves this pleasure?
Well, you're right, and it's certainly a unique political tradition that we have in Iowa. Everything from, you know, the fact that candidates sort of traditionally gather there for, you know, weeks and months in advance, and really often historically have really invested in, you know, on the ground organizing and all of these sort of kind of American political traditions that we have now, like parading around the state fair and knocking on doors and. So it certainly is something that has been with us for a while, and Iowans would, you know, be the first ones to say that we absolutely should keep this system. And their argument would mostly be that, you know, by forcing candidates to kind of descend on the state, it allows voters to really get up close and personal with them and really vet the candidates in a way that, you know, might not be possible in a bigger state and might not be possible if the candidates were sort of forced to go through, in a way, kind of this bottleneck where they have to get into close contact with voters.
Okay, so all kidding aside, let's talk about some history. Iowa, the Iowa caucus is not in terms of, well, in terms of geologic time is an eye blink, but it hasn't always been there. How did we get there? How is it we got this calendar with the Iowa caucus first and then the New Hampshire primary?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's not, I think a lot of people might assume that it's some sort of strategic reason, but in a sense, the reason why we have Iowa going first sort of comes down to logistics and then inertia, in a sense. You had, you know, going a few decades back, the Democratic Party decided that, you know, it wanted to sort of reorganize the order and kind of create a little bit more order in the primary process. And because Iowa has such a complex caucus system, and the caucus system, and we can talk a little bit more about this if it's worth going into detail, but, you know, the caucuses really function very different than a primary. They involve, you know, they're these local neighborhood meetings. They take place in all of the precincts in the state. There's just a lot of logistical sort of preparation that goes into it. And so in Iowa, they decided that they needed to hold it earlier to make sure that sort of all of the logistics could be kind of accounted for. And it wasn't so much that nobody sort of sat down and consciously said, you know, we want Iowa to have kind of this outsized influence in the political process. It had more to do with just making sure that there's enough time to get the caucuses organized. And once that happened, in a sense, some of what happened next was just, you know, candidates started to realize that if they were to come to Iowa first and to really spend a lot of time there, it was sort of a way to grab media attention, to grab the national spotlight. And they realized that if they were to do well in Iowa, it could sort of set the tone for the rest of the election, kind of become this symbolic victory. And that's sort of how the tradition unfolded, where candidates started to really spend a lot of time on the ground there.
Well, and certainly we saw that in 2008 with Barack Obama really launching himself with the Iowa caucus, bringing a lot of new people in to the process and defeating Hillary Clinton there. Of course, the results are in now, and Hillary apparently learned her lesson. It was a narrow victory over Bernie Sanders, but a victory nonetheless. What about New Hampshire? You know, they before the Iowa caucus, they were the very first. I mean, the New Hampshire primary has a tradition that goes back a long ways.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, Iowa and New Hampshire are both, you know, they're both sort of these states that get to go first in the nominating contests. And I think that it's important to both that they get to have sort of this badge of almost uniqueness. And although New Hampshire is, in a sense, relegated to this second place because it comes after Iowa, it still gets to claim the title of first primary in the nation. And again, although that might not seem like a major distinction, it's a badge of pride and honor for New Hampshire. And in fact, Iowa and New Hampshire have both subsequently passed laws within the state saying, you know, in New Hampshire, they have a law that says, you know, we have to be the first primary, and Iowa has this law, we have to be the first caucus. Because, you know, even if New Hampshire does come on the heels of Iowa, it's still, you know, the fact that it still gets to go so early has given it also this place of political prestige that the state's really mm-hmm. proud of and will kind of do anything to hold on to.
Okay, so let's get a little bit into the weeds here. In your article, you wrote, in an election year that has so far defied expectation, there are murmurs, even veiled threats, that the states risk losing their vaunted status if candidates who challenge the priorities of the political establishment pull off upsets. Who's making the threats, and why are they being made? And maybe in light of what happened last night, we could get into that a little more.
Yeah, well. So first, it's important to note that, you know, this kind of general conversation of, you know, why do Iowa and New Hampshire get to go first, and is that fair, and should they get to do that? It does come up, you know, pretty much every 4 years when voters kind of tune into the political process and kind of scratch their heads a little bit and kind of ask this question. And there's certainly always been other states that have been interested in kind of claiming the title and kind of stealing it out of the hands of Iowa and New Hampshire, because getting to go first, you know, it really is a big deal. I mean, not only does it allow the states to bring in, I mean, it brings in a lot of business and revenue for the states, because think about it, you have campaigns sort of descending on the states, you know, they're spending money, they're doing events, all of that's bringing in money for local business, so there's the economic impact, and then it also is just a prestige issue, and it's a chance for the state as well to sort of advocate, to some extent, its kind of special interests. You've seen that traditionally in Iowa with the renewable fuel standard and ethanol, which is this policy that's historically been really important to the corn industry there. And that's sort of this policy that, you know, might not get that much national attention, but because candidates have to pass through Iowa, they've sort of historically kind of had to pledge allegiance to that policy and, you know, say that they like it and they support it if they want to win the state. So that's how things have been. But this year, you know, there's been some things that have been a little bit different, and going to that idea of kind of the veiled threats. So you've seen these more on the Republican side of the aisle. In the fall, the RNC chairman, he made a comment where he said, you know, after 2016, we're not going to consider Iowa and New Hampshire sacred cows anymore. And that comment sort of set off a flurry of speculation of people just sort of wondering, well, what does that mean? You know, does that mean that the party, you know, might reconsider? And there's certainly reasons why the Republican establishment might want to reconsider, namely the fact that in Iowa, Iowa is not necessarily demographically representative of the rest of the country, and evangelical Christian conservative voters play a particularly large role in electing the Republican nominee there. That's been argued by some people that that might not be helpful to Republicans because essentially, it sort of causes candidates to play to that vote. And maybe ultimately that means that the state selects a Republican nominee that's not going to do well in the rest of the country. So that's kind of the argument for the Republican side of why they might want to change the order. And so you've seen some murmurs in the Republican establishment, but you've also seen Republican presidential candidates making some threats or kind of warning, signaling kind of a warning themselves. So another aspect of the Iowa and New Hampshire campaigns that's considered very traditional is this idea of retail politics. So it's the idea of you go out on the ground, you shake hands, you kiss babies, you go to restaurants, you go to coffee shops, you get to know voters. Now, Donald Trump has kind of defied that expectation. And as we saw yesterday, you know, maybe that didn't work out so well for him in the end in Iowa. But he's done in Iowa and New Hampshire, he's really kind of jetted into the state for the most part, held these massive rallies, and not necessarily stuck around and spent as much time getting to know voters. And so Chris Christie has made comments where in New Hampshire in particular, where he's kind of said to the state, you know, if you elect Donald Trump, you're sending a message basically that candidates don't need to come here and kind of pay homage to the voters, pay homage to the state. And he's basically explicitly said, you know, if Donald Trump wins, you're kind of telling the rest of the world that maybe we don't need to have kind of this special system. So that kind of gets to the threats.
Okay, but what difference would it make then? I mean, who went first? Because going back to the religious conservatives in Iowa, which state then would the Republicans hold their first caucus where that wouldn't be the case?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think that part of the reason why the inertia has taken hold and that it's probably unlikely that we will see another state kind of depose Iowa is because, right, what state would be the ideal state? Certainly when you look at the primary process, so first we have Iowa, then we have New Hampshire, then you get into South Carolina and Nevada. Now those states are more diverse than Iowa and New Hampshire. And so some people, you know, look to them and say, well, you know, those states are maybe demographically more of what we should be aiming for. But it's a really hard question to answer. I mean, how can you say that any one state is kind of the ideal vision of America or American voters? And the fact that it's so hard to answer that question is part of the reason why Iowa and New Hampshire have remained first.
Well, and then let's talk about New Hampshire. I mean, Chris Christie's complaints aside, I mean, again, what difference would it make what state you started with if there was going to be an insurgency from an outsider, say a Donald Trump, and certainly the Democrats have had their own. Good grief! I mean, George McGovern was an insurgent, and he was one of the people responsible for the Iowa caucuses getting started. And so, if you're going to have an insurgent candidacy, what difference would it make whether New Hampshire was first or South Carolina or Connecticut or some other state?
Well, I think that's a good point as well. And the thing to keep in mind with Donald Trump, I mean, not only has he been this insurgent candidate, but also in so many ways he's this political outlier because we're talking about somebody who is a former reality television star who already came into the race with an extremely high name recognition. You know, this is a person who people know who he is to a degree that is very uncommon to most politicians. And so, for example, for Trump to be able to go into these states, do these big rallies, and not spend as much time getting to know voters and still stay high in the polls, you know, somebody like Chris Christie might look at that and kind of say, you better not reward this, or you're going to send this signal that politicians don't need to do retail campaigning. But it's also important to note that Trump's maybe an outlier. And so whatever, like, let's say he wins New Hampshire, somebody like Chris Christie or somebody who's kind of has some bitter grapes over sour grapes over the outcome might kind of point at that and kind of scold New Hampshire voters and sort of say you shouldn't have rewarded that. But I don't necessarily think that other politicians would take that message away that they could get away with not spending much time in the state because not everybody is Donald Trump.
Well, he certainly comes in with rock star status. There is some question as to how that did play out in Iowa, and we did talk in detail about the Iowa caucus system yesterday with a professor who's known as Dr. Politics at Iowa, one of the things we speculated on was whether or not Donald Trump had the ground game to get his supporters to the caucus sites and supporting him. I don't know what we learned yesterday. Yeah. It was assumed that Ted Cruz had a great organization in Iowa, and that apparently helped him carry the day. We'll see what happens in New Hampshire. I'll tell you what. Let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion. And I'd like to know from our listeners, does it matter to you which state goes first? Maybe you're from Iowa. What if the Iowa caucus wasn't the first caucus? How would you feel about that? What is this pride of place worth to you if you're from Iowa? If not, does it matter to you which state goes first? Do you think Iowa and New Hampshire should maintain their status as the first in the nation, the first caucus, the first primary? Is that tradition important to maintain, or does it matter? Perhaps you're one of those who says, hey, you know what? We should just have a national primary, all 50 states. Let's let them all go on the same day. We'll make it the super-duper Tuesday. That's an idea that's been floated before. Maybe that would be more representative of the population as a whole. If we did that, would give more people a voice in helping to select the presidential candidates. Any of those things is open for discussion this hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show. Here's how to get in touch. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email is talk@WPR.org, or you can find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and Twitter. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Kathleen Dunn Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen this week. And today we're talking about the early voting states and whether or not they should maintain their status. Iowa, the first caucus in the nation. New Hampshire, the first presidential primary. And critics say that voters in those states don't represent the politics of the country and that they unfairly hijack the process. And there has been some talk about moving those states out of their top spots, and we're discussing that. What do you think? Should Iowa and New Hampshire always host the first presidential nominating contests? And how do you think these early primary states impact the issues we talk about in the presidential race? And if Iowa isn't first, then who? Would you support maybe a rotating system? What do you think? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. My guest, Claire Ferran, associate editor at The Atlantic. Before she was with The Atlantic, she was a staff writer at the National Journal. Okay, so obviously, we didn't get any earth-shattering results. Some in Iowa, people expected Donald Trump to win. He did not. People expected Hillary to win in Iowa. She didn't win by as much as some people would have liked, but a victory is a victory. We talked about how there was some unrest on the Republican side about Iowa and New Hampshire. What about on the Democratic side? I mean, do we have people within the party complaining about the influence that Iowa and New Hampshire have on the race?
So the Democratic side hasn't featured really many prominent voices sort of talking about the order or kind of lamenting the order. But I think that when you look at the way that So as you mentioned, you know, the criticism of these states is that they are not demographically representative of the rest of the country, and that it's sort of in that sense unfair. And so you haven't really seen Democratic Party leaders talking much about this, but I think it'll be interesting to see how Bernie Sanders performs in Iowa and New Hampshire compared to what happens when he gets to South Carolina and Nevada, which will be coming up, you know, just on their heels and are much sort of more diverse electorates. And the interesting question to look at will be, does he do well in Iowa and New Hampshire, which are states that are very rural, not very diverse? That's a demographic he tends to do well with. And then does he sort of totally falter in South Carolina and Nevada? And if that happens, I think that it's not going to make the it's not going to make sort of the order look very good for the Democrats, because it's going to look like they've kind of boosted this candidate who's not very appealing to a broader base. But there
Hang on a second. When we talk about, okay, this state is more has a population that's more diverse than some other state, but don't we have to refine that? I mean, it's kind of like when we do a poll. If we just do a general poll of the entire population and they say, oh, we like this candidate or that candidate, and then Election Day comes around and the people who actually voted had a different point of view, you know, that's why, I mean, when we poll people and we poll, well, was that poll likely voters? Then you might get a different story. So by the same token, so let's say it's Nevada or South Carolina, what do we know about the people who are actually likely to vote in a primary and about their likely behavior? And would it be that much different than what we see in Iowa and New Hampshire?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, because obviously it's the way that polling works, too, it can always be, as we saw with Iowa, because we had, I mean, if you looked at, in the case of Iowa, we had a very widely respected pollster putting out a Des Moines Register poll right before the caucus, and that was predicting that Trump would win. So that was wrong. All of these kind of predictions need to be kind of caveated with, you know, it might not turn out that way once votes are actually cast. But what we do know in terms of the makeup of the electorate in these early voting states is that, so again, Iowa and New Hampshire are much more rural, and they tend to have just a much higher proportion of white voters that turn out to vote in these primary nominating contests compared to South Carolina and Nevada. South Carolina in particular has a lot more African-American voters, and that's a group that a voting bloc that Hillary Clinton has traditionally done well with and that Bernie Sanders has not done well with. So it could create a bit of a contrast when we finally get to votes cast in that state, and we'll have to see.
Okay. All right, let's take some calls. We have some people who want to talk about this topic, and you could be one of them. A couple of lines available for you right now if you call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll start in West Allis, where Joanne is with us. Joanne, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for taking my call. I just had a question. Does your guest think that it will ever get to the point where there will be like a Super Tuesday where all the states have a primary at one time, with technology being what it is today? That would save the candidates from running themselves ragged for month after month after month. And also, if a person wanted to vote for Mark O'Malley after one caucus, they can't do that anymore. Or like in 2008, I had some friends who wanted to vote for Hillary just because she would have been the first woman president, and they couldn't because by the time they got to their state, Barack was the nominee. So it just doesn't seem like a fair democracy when you really can't vote for the candidate of your choice because they were already eliminated by some other states.
Joanne, thanks for that. Claire, what do you think? A national primary, would that solve some of these problems?
Well, I think that, it is a good point. And I mean, the idea of, you know, if there were to be a national primary, kind of the idea that everybody could kind of vote at one time, it certainly would be a completely different ballgame. And you wouldn't have, as the caller points out, this sort of staggered process that really does impact the course of the race. As far as the feasibility and likelihood of that, I mean, I think that it's probably not too likely, mostly because, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire, these two early nominating states, they have so much invested in their status, and they're really willing to kind of raise their voice, do whatever it takes, to try to maintain that status. And when I was working on my story, you know, I spoke with people who've studied and written about this, and they sort of just said that, sure, other states are interested in this kind of coveted early status, but Iowa and New Hampshire traditionally have been, really tenacious and kind of fighting to hold on to it. And there just hasn't traditionally been that will on the part of other states to really change the system.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would take something really big to see a change.
Well, these are things the political parties do to help select their nominee, and people may forget that it hasn't really been that long ago when the primaries were really irrelevant, if there were any, and that candidates for president were chosen at conventions, usually in rooms full of cigar smoke. And backroom deals being made about who would win on which ballot and who would be the vice president. It was pretty much all decided before any voting took place. And so we've come a long way from there, and maybe a national primary would be the next step. I would think one of the things about a national primary, if we had one, would be that those candidates who didn't have a lot of money would be pretty limited. It would be tough to run a national campaign if you were, you know, one of the more outlier candidates, unless you were somebody like Donald Trump who had access to your own money. That would be one thing. On the other hand, you would eliminate that whole problem that people have talked about, where the issues in Iowa may be a little more parochial than they would be on the national stage, and that might change the debate a little bit, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, I think your point about the kind of the question of money for a national primary is an important one to take into account, because the argument that's made in favor of Iowa and New Hampshire is that it's sort of public dissatisfaction with kind of the flood of money in politics is relatively high, and the counter argument in support of Iowa and New Hampshire is that, you know, because it's so important, or historically has been so important, for candidates to get out to the state, to visit early and often, to be on the ground, meeting with voters, asking their questions, that it allows for this kind of personal, individual, one-on-one vetting that wouldn't be possible if we just had a national primary. Because so imagine if we just had a national primary and everybody was sort of casting votes on the same day, you know, where would candidates campaign? I mean, they would be spread very thin, and it would probably be, there would be a lot more spending on things like, television ads, radio ads, that kind of a running of a campaign, which is very costly. And so, again, the argument in favor of kind of forcing the candidates to pass through this kind of bottleneck of these two early voting states is that it forces this one-on-one contact with voters.
Mm-hmm. Here's another idea that one of our callers who couldn't stay on the line suggested. Maybe we should have the smaller states all go first, and save the big states with all the delegates, the big lots of delegates, for the end. So there's still, there's kind of a stake in this thing right up until the end of the primary season. I mean, one of the things that's happened is, one candidate will gather enough delegates to pretty much end this, and then, mm-hmm. You still have primaries left. People are still trying to vote. And yet there's really, it's kind of, it makes the rest of the process meaningless. Maybe we could have more drama if we organized the states so that you couldn't get all of the delegates you needed for the nomination without going through the entire process.
Yeah, I mean, that would be one way to do it. And certainly when you talk about the idea of smaller states, again, with Iowa and New Hampshire, it's sort of this double-edged sword where, critics will say, well, they're so small that they're not representative. But the smallness of the state also allows candidates to, I mean, you have the possibility for people like Rick Santorum to do, or Ted Cruz to try to take this 99-county approach in Iowa, where they are really literally visiting kind of every corner of the state. And again, that sort of exemplifies this idea of, do we want to have an election where candidates are forced to interact with voters, or do we want elections where they can kind of keep their distance, spend a lot of money on radio and television ads, and kind of leave it at that? And so smaller states do provide an advantage to that, because it makes it possible for candidates to really traverse the mm-hmm. states in a way that wouldn't be if they were much larger.
Let's take some more calls. There's a line available for you if you'd like to call now, 800-642-1234. Campbellsport will be our next destination, and Eva is on the line. Eva, hello.
Hi. I guess I wanted to put my vote in for the Super Duper Tuesday also. I would almost think it would be easier for the candidates further down, because rather than having to make that big push on every single state, and then running out of money, which is what most of them are doing, because it's mm-hmm. been several times by the time that we get around to good old Wisconsin, there's my guy's gone. It just would seem fair. I mean, I understand in the days of when they were riding on a train and had to go from town to town and you only got the newspaper once a week to tell you what was happening. But, you know, we listen to this all across the country 24 hours a day. I think we're beyond the one state. I think it'd just be really good for all of us if we could do it in one big bash and get it over with.
All right, Eva, thanks for that. So another vote for having a Super Duper Tuesday. I don't know if that name is going to fly. The marketing department is probably going to have a say in that. But you know, having one national primary, we're in the 24-hour news cycle. There's certainly, I mean, the term ad nauseum could easily be applied to the coverage of presidential candidates. Good grief, we seem to be in the endless election cycle now. Even though it really officially started yesterday, we've been going at this ever since November of 2012.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely the case that this has been a more the election has sort of taken on a more national flavor early on in this race, and you've seen that particularly in decisions that the party establishments and the media networks have made too, as far as holding, you know, we've had all of these presidential debates on the Republican side, for example. A lot of those have been based on national polling. So, you know, arguably, even if you had a candidate that was focusing a lot of time in Iowa, New Hampshire, but let's say they were only focusing time there, they weren't going to make a dent necessarily in national polls, and they weren't going to get that national spotlight that everybody else was getting. Plus, you have, with the rise of social media, you know, you have this ability for candidates to kind of quickly and easily reach a national audience instantaneously. So I do think that I think that that's having an impact on the way that the elections are playing out, and I think that one potential example of that is seeing, you know, in Iowa we had this interesting scenario where so Ted Cruz won Iowa, and on the one hand he ran a traditional campaign in the sense that he got out and he really spent a lot of time on the ground in the state, but he did not support this policy, the renewable fuel standard, that traditionally has been something that the corn industry in that state has really pushed, and critics would sort of say, you know, that's an example of special interests in the state having this outsized influence. Now, Cruz opposed the policy. I mean, he calls for an end to it, and that's something that in the past has been kind of a death blow to candidates. And I think that Cruz's calculation of sort of not kissing the ring of the corn industry in this case, to some extent, speaks to the fact that we're seeing this more nationalized race, and he knows that, you know, he can kind of take this position and it's going to reach the rest of the country, and maybe it doesn't make sense for him to kind of pick out a stance that's going to play well in the state but might alienate other conservative voters nationally. And so I think we're seeing this national kind of character to the race change the way that candidates are making calculations. But to the point that the caller made, you know, you still see Iowa and New Hampshire playing this role of winnowing the field. You know, we saw that last night. You see somebody like Mike Huckabee, he drops out, Martin O'Malley drops out because they just couldn't crack, you know, the polls. And so these states do still have that power of kind of being able to, in a sense, crush a campaign. And it's sort of an open question, you know, how would those candidates have fared if it was, you know, every state voting and then not just sort of this one particular one. So
mm-hmm. Let's get one more call in before we have to go to break. This time we'll go to Rice Lake, and Jim is there. Jim, hello.
Hi, I'm in favor of like a rotating regional primary system, and above all, getting rid of the Iowa caucus. The Iowa and New Hampshire are whiter than a Wisconsin snowstorm, and what we get out of the Iowa caucus on the Republican side is the evangelical Christian candidate for president. Because whether it's Cruz or Santorum, it's all we repeat the same, and we always know who's not going to get the Republican nomination. So, and I think it particularly drives the Republican Party to the far right too early, too hard, and not to the benefit of the people of America generally. And I'll take your response off the air.
Jim, thanks for those thoughts. Well, Claire, that kind of goes along with what you were saying earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's pretty undeniable that the evangelical, you know, Christian conservative vote is really important for the Republicans in Iowa. And, you know, as the caller mentioned, so we've had, if you look at the previous Iowa caucuses, we've had, you know, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee win. Both have done really well with evangelicals. Neither one have sort of had any shot at winning the presidency, you know, once they kind of got past you know, that early kind of voting stage of the race. And, yeah, I think that those, I mean, the fact that we saw, again, on the Republican side, you know, Huckabee and Santorum win and then just totally run aground in later states, I mean, I think it certainly raises the point that, you know, the winnowing effect of Iowa is maybe not helpful, at least in terms of the party's chances of you know, getting a candidate to have momentum that will then be able to win the White House.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more of our conversation with Claire Foran and with you, should you choose to join us at 800-642-1234, or find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour on the Kathleen Dunn Show, we're talking politics again, and we're discussing whether or not Iowa and New Hampshire should retain their status as the first caucus and first primary states in the nation. And there's certainly some sentiment among our callers so far to make some changes. There are objections to the lack of diversity in Iowa and New Hampshire. People want to have primaries and caucuses in states that are more reflective of the nation as a whole. And there are objections to this, or there are threats to the system from within the parties themselves. Party hierarchies not always being too happy with insurgent candidates who emerge from Iowa or New Hampshire. And so we're talking about that this hour. And we are talking with Claire Foran, who is associate editor at The Atlantic. She recently wrote an article titled "The Uncertain Fate of Early Voting States, Iowa and New Hampshire Political Clout Could Ride on the Results of the 2016 Race." That caught our attention, and here we are. So let's take some more phone calls. Claire, Ray, and Rhinelander. Nice alliteration on that one. We'll go to Ray next. Ray, good afternoon.
Hi. Thank you, Claire. I like your article and articles, so you write very well. I think we should have a national primary. And the reason for this is the diverse population that we have. Let's look at the psychology of this. You have this in the Midwest and the East Coast. Once again, it's a status quo. People feel they are left out in other parts of the country. They're not being accepted or represented. And a large part of everybody's uptightness nowadays is that. We hear it. We're talked about. And I think overall, if every state would be represented that day on Super Tuesday, you would just get a better range, and people would feel they're putting a part into this. It's not just about who's running. It's the people. I mean, we vote for, in the end, for who we want to every state. I think this, you know, that would be more fair, and people would feel they would have a bigger part in all this. And I'll take your comment off there, and thanks again for having us on.
Ray, thanks for the call. Claire, you have a fan.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, too, to hear that, you know, all the calls that we've had so far are seem to be kind of in favor of knocking Iowa and New Hampshire kind of off the map in terms of their special status. And I think that that does sort of speak to the fact that, you know, we do really have, I mean, it's just these two states that, again, pretty small states, not that big population. And it is kind of interesting to see that, you know, I feel like there probably is a fair amount of sort of discontent across the country that, you know, these states have this position of power and privilege. And even if Iowa and New Hampshire kind of claim, because Iowa and New Hampshire sort of claim that they're speaking for the rest of the U.S., you know, they say, okay, sure, these candidates are coming here, but we kind of vet the candidates in a way that ultimately benefits all Americans. But you know, as many of the callers have made the point, they're not necessarily representative. And so, you know, the kind of questions that voters on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire are going to be asking the questions and then sort of are most important to them, you know, might not be the priorities at all of voters in other states. And if we were to have, you know, a different system or maybe a national primary, you know, perhaps that would be more fair in that sense.
Well, and people need to kind of understand the difference between a party caucus and a primary. I mean, a primary is actually an election, and there are voting booths and things like that. Caucuses are political animals entirely operated by political parties and for their own purposes. They are not the same thing, and they're often quite often confused. 800-642-1234, still a chance for you to get in on our discussion, as Ken in Oconto Falls wants to do. Let's go there next. Hi, Ken.
Good afternoon. Missed the first portion of the program, but kind of hit a vein with me on this after seeing the process that we're going through now. I have to remember that nominations really are political party functions, and in my opinion, they've been serving us badly in the last several cycles. Party activists are on the fringes of both the right and the left. Candidates need to kind of pander to those fringes in order to get nominated, but then they have to change tack and move towards the center in order to get elected, which is where most of the voters in the country are. So I guess I would like to see, I'm not holding out much hope that this would happen, but we'd be much better served if we had a national primary that really allowed people to run without regard to party affiliation. Use that process to winnow the number of candidates down to the top two or three or four, whatever number, based on support that they have received, and then run the election to elect the person that really does represent the choice of the majority of all voters in the country.
Ken, thanks for your comment. Claire?
I guess the idea of, you know, running a process that would be sort of without regard to party affiliation is certainly an interesting idea to think about. I mean, it's definitely true that, and it's interesting to just see in the primary process in general, even setting aside Iowa and New Hampshire, you know, you sort of have this pulling to the right on the Republican side, pulling to the left on the Democratic side, as the candidates sort of play to their base in this kind of election within the election that's targeted, you know, just at the parties. And I think that there's definitely reason to think that might not be good for the political process as a whole, in that it really does sort of, to some extent, you know, it causes these candidates to sort of pull to the fringes before then they trying to come more into the center for a general. And then I think that Iowa and New Hampshire sort of exacerbate that by adding this other level of, then you have kind of these issues that are particularly resonant in those states that then the candidates play to. So it's kind of another level of that pulling.
Well, and one thing that we talked about yesterday afternoon when we were discussing the Iowa caucus on the Kathleen Dunn Show is that those edges are becoming farther and farther apart. So it seems like we're going to reach a point, if we haven't already, where it really isn't even possible for somebody to come back to the center far enough or close enough to the center to win a national election. It's going to be very, very challenging, given the extremes that we're seeing on both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, I think that it's, and in this election cycle too, you know, I feel like it's been a very sort of divisive race in terms of seeing candidates who have offered up fairly, you know, very kind of vocal and kind of extreme positions on the Republican side. I won't name any names, but on the Democratic side, you know, you have Clinton, who has tried to run as a centrist candidate, but I think that even in the case of Clinton, it's interesting to me how much and how willing she is to call Republicans the enemy, which in some senses presents sort of a stark contrast to the way that Obama ran his campaign, where he tried to make this point over and over, you know, we're not just red states and blue states, we're the United States of America, trying to maintain this message of unity going into the general. You know, Clinton has said that she's able to work with Republicans, but she frequently calls out Republicans by name, and I do think that heading into the general, you know, it'll be interesting to see where voters land, but I think it's been fairly divisive.
Mm-hmm. Hey, here's a comment from someone who's also named Claire on Facebook, who basically says, it doesn't bother me that Iowa's first. I actually think that Iowa is representative of a lot of states in that they have broad rural areas with pockets of dense, somewhat racially and economically diverse urban areas. What bothers me more is that the debates didn't really address an urban agenda at all, and it seemed that Iowa was just one big cornfield. So Claire isn't bothered by the diversity, but she is talking about the lack of diversity in the discussion.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I think it kind of gets this question of whenever you're talking about politics, I feel like I feel like you kind of brought this up a little bit earlier when you were talking about, you know, we talk about the electorate, but what do we really know about it? And in politics, I think one of the pitfalls in general is that there's always this idea of conventional wisdom. So it's kind of what people tell themselves to be true about politics. And then it just gets repeated so many times to the point that people stop actually digging and finding out the facts. And I think it's definitely possible that in the case of something like Iowa and New Hampshire, you know, you have these kind of standard lines of criticism. Oh, it's not representative. And maybe that creates its own stereotype of Iowa's, you know, only being cornfields, that then on a national level, you know, that becomes kind of the criticism. And maybe that's not fair to Iowa. You know, I mean, I haven't actually been to Iowa myself, but, you know, obviously every state is going to have a lot to it. And yeah, perhaps it's not fair to kind of paint it with a broad brush.
Let's go to another caller. We'll hear from Jackie in Milwaukee next. Hello.
Yes. My concern, if you went with a single national primary, is you're creating just the opposite problem, because then you're having only a few densely populated states making the decision. So what I would suggest is a series of maybe six regional primaries that would give a balance to sparsely populated states like Iowa and heavily populated states like New York and California.
All right. What about Jackie's idea, Claire?
Yeah, I mean, I could see that potentially being a way to take into account you know, kind of balancing the regional differences and disparities. And, I mean, I think that there's definitely, getting back to this idea of regional issues, I mean, there's, you know, in Iowa, we see sort of ethanol and then this policy that affects the corn industry. And in New Hampshire, we've seen candidates really talking a lot about prescription drug abuse and opioid abuse, which is a big issue in New Hampshire and matters a lot to a lot of New Hampshire voters. And I think that the fact that we've seen those two issues really just get a lot of airtime in the race, again, just does speak to the fact that, you know, different states and different parts of the country have different issues that matter the most to them. And, you know, that there's probably issues in a lot of other states that aren't getting that airtime early on in the debates simply because the candidates don't have to kind of pass through those states. So perhaps if there were some kind of a system that could take sort of regions into account more, maybe that would create a more balanced discussion.
Well, the conventional wisdom is that you can't win your party's nomination without winning at least one of the first two primary states. Of course, the outlier there, Bill Clinton. And no candidate since has accomplished what Clinton did. He won the nomination without winning either one of the first two states. That may have been because in 1992, Iowa had favorite son Tom Harkin, and Paul Tsongas, man, I forgot that name, won in New Hampshire. Clinton was later billed a comeback kid despite losing each of the first four primaries or caucuses, but he went on to win the nomination. So it is possible. It requires perhaps a special kind of candidate to do that. What do you think is, based on the results, do you think that some of the concerns for party insiders were answered there, or are they not that crazy about Mr. Cruz either?
Oh, well, yeah, party insiders are definitely not that crazy about Mr. Cruz. It was actually, I think it was the Republican National Committee that sent out sort of a release last night commenting on the on the announcement and the call of the race for Cruz, and I think didn't even mention him. I mean, the Trump-Cruz sort of rise on the Republican side has been interesting because it's just really given kind of the party establishment fits. Ted Cruz is very, there's a lot of animosity towards him in Washington, D.C., mostly because he has consistently sort of been a thorn in the side to party leaders in Congress. As far as what the results in Iowa tell us, I mean, I think one thing that you're definitely going to see is you're going to see people saying, well, Cruz won, and he did the traditional style of campaigning in the sense that he invested heavily into the state, and he was there. He was on the ground. So I think, and then Trump did not do that in comparison. So I think one narrative that's going to come out of Iowa is people are going to say, you know, that old Iowa way of campaigning, of needing to be in the state, works, and Cruz's victory validated that, and candidates need to keep doing that. So I think that'll be, you know, whether or not that's why he won, I think that will be what people talk about.
We've got about a minute left. What do you think it would take to see changes happen, say, even by 2020? Is that even possible? Are we likely to see changes? And if we were going to, how would it take place?
Well, I think that, I mean, going back to what I had said earlier about the RNC chair commenting on Iowa and New Hampshire, I believe he specifically said, you know, Iowa and New Hampshire aren't going to be sacred cows after 2016. So I think that that comment at least indicated that there's an appetite to talking about this issue and to looking at it. But again, it's, you know, with people that I spoke with for this, there's a lot of inertia here. You know, there's a burst of activity and attention, and everybody wants to talk about it when Iowa and New Hampshire go to vote. But afterwards, the dust kind of settles, people kind of forget about it, and there's less kind of a push that would maybe actually result in change. I think that the most likely scenario that would result in change, if there were to be some kind of outcome of the election that was deemed just absolutely abhorrent to party leaders, and they decided that it had something to do with it being Iowa and New Hampshire, and that they really needed to address it. But it's probably not incredibly likely that that will take place.
Okay. Well, Claire, thanks so much for joining us this hour. I really appreciate your time, and I enjoyed reading your article.
Thank you so much for having me.
Claire Foran is an associate editor at The Atlantic, and before The Atlantic, she was a staff writer at the National Journal. She wrote an article titled "The Uncertain Fate of Early Voting States, Iowa and New Hampshire's Political Clout Could Ride on the Results of the 2016 Race." That was the article that caught our attention and resulted in this hour of The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks so much to Scott Myers for producing this program, and KP Whaley for handling on-air production. Dave Potratz handled technical production for us this afternoon as well. Another hour to go, so stay tuned. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about the private tax system that exists for the extremely wealthy. You may not have known that existed. Well, you'll find out about it tomorrow at 1. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.